Just over a year ago, there was a book which was very popular in the United States, written by a professor of philosophy and English at the University of Chicago. And it was called The Closing of the American Mind. It was a description by a college professor of what had happened to college students. He observes about them in his book that they are unable to establish close relationships, that they do not speak of love or romance, that they come basically from broken homes, which they feel have betrayed them, and that they themselves do not feel confident about establishing relationships with others. The interesting thing about this book is that it was decided by this author that that did not begin in the 1960s, but that it was more than 200 years old, the process that had created this obvious dissolution of the American family and of the American society. And he said the reason for it is because we have entered an age of democracy in which there has been the decision made that all values must be determined democratically, and therefore all values are relative. We know what is right by consensus. We know what is wrong by consensus. And obviously the consensus changes, therefore the system of values changes. And I want to talk to you tonight about some guidelines for rearing godly children. But I want us to understand as we begin that we are doing this job, we are accomplishing this task in the most untoward kind of environment. But it didn't just start yesterday. Much as I would like to say that things went bad in the 1960s or they started going bad in the 1950s, it's probably right to say that they've been going in the wrong direction for a long, long time, insofar that society no longer is shaped and built with a common conviction that right and wrong are known by all of us. And we are committed to those right things and to those wrong things we object. We don't have a society like that. We probably haven't had a society like that for a long time. And if I remember a society like that in my young days, it's probably because it was a cut flower civilization that was just living off the fumes of an earlier time. Does this mean that we can't accomplish what needs to be accomplished? It does not. Does it mean that we're going to have to accept our task soberly and diligently and carefully and seriously? It does. We have some young people who recently married. We have some who are anticipating. We have some who have now been blessed by the Lord with their first child. We have others that are in the midst of rearing children that are still young. We have some that are struggling with the challenges of bringing adolescent children to the point of maturity. But all of it is a result of approaching things in the right way, starting out with what Steve has led us in understanding tonight, with some rock-solid truths that are established in an unchanging God and Christ. You and I need these for a lot of reasons. It's not just rearing children becomes impossible. It's not just a society that becomes impossible without this unchanging, solid foundation of values. Everything becomes impossible. Life loses all direction and all point. As we think about these guidelines, there's some things that need to gain our attention at the beginning, that it is a tremendous blessing to have children. It's not something imposed on us as a burden. There's something about humankind that delights in the thought of bringing children into the world, not just women, who have, I think, been given by God a rather natural inclination to be strongly attached to children, and perhaps it's because they're the ones who are so intimately involved in the bearing of them. But men too. And we see in this act of bearing children and rearing children our destiny. But it's got to be more than that. We've got to recognize, as the passage in the 18th chapter of Proverbs says in verse 22, that whoso finds a wife finds a good thing, and he'll receive favor from the Lord, that's a blessing. And it's a blessing because in Psalm 127 and verse 3 says, children are a heritage from God. They're a blessing. We are intended as their parents to be a blessing to them. They're a blessing to us. They're a part of our destiny, but we've got to recognize that it's God's gift. And because it's God's gift and because it's under God's direction, we have to have counsel from Him to accomplish it. Most of the things tonight, if not all of them, you will know already. I am intending simply to call to your mind what you know already and to make you even more keenly aware of things that need to be concerning you at this time in your life. Not only is having children a great blessing, but it's a tremendous responsibility. And I have to tell you that I don't think people in this generation take it very seriously. In fact, I don't think any relationship is taken very seriously in this society. It's been a long time eroding. The most obvious manifestation of it has come when the ugliest surfacing of this individualistic idea that what I want is what is right came to the fore in this country. Individualism, we call it. Other people call it narcissism. The fascination with oneself. But whatever the case, what it says is that my life will be governed and directed by what fulfills me. I accept no duty, no responsibility that is greater than my need to find self-fulfillment. Is that a selfish philosophy? Obviously. Will it destroy all relationships? Equally obviously. It's interesting about people. We want to enter relationships in which the other person thinks we're more important than anything, but we don't want to think they're more important than anything. We want to make them secondary to more important concerns, selfish concerns. But we don't want anything to get ahead of their love of us. Now, if we are going to take our responsibility as soberly as we need to, we'll know, as Proverbs 22 says, that if we train up a child in the way that he should go when he is old, he won't depart from it. We'll understand this proverbial statement that what we do as parents in the lives of our children are going to have a significant influence in the direction of those lives. It's not possible for us to resign from responsibility. We biologically got into this thing. Our children ought to do right because we had them. And if they don't do right, it's not my fault and it's not my burden. And I'm not going to carry any guilt around about that. Well, I'm sorry. But that's just not the way it is. The reason God arranged things as He has arranged them is because it's intended that parents be the nurturers of children, guides to children, mentors to children, examples to children. Children would not even learn to be human if it were not for adults who speak to them, nurture them, cherish them. So it's our responsibility, and it's a serious one, that we need to take with seriousness. I want to point something out to you tonight. We talk so much about what is the secret, you know, of something. What's the secret of effective child rearing? What is the secret of being a good father, good mother? Well, I have to tell you, the secret of being a good father and a good mother is the secret of being the kind of person you ought to be, whether you're a mother or father, whatever you are. If you never become a father or mother, the secret it is in who you are. Your whole life comes out of your mind and decisions you make inside your head. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, said the Proverbist in the 23rd chapter of Proverbs, verse 7. And he also made the observation challenging us in Proverbs 4:23, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. So if you want to be a good father, you better decide to be a good person. And if you want to know what a good person is, you need to examine the thoughts of the Almighty to find out what produces that kind of individual. Some of us never quite get around to this until we're thinking about, oh, I'm about to be a father. I better start thinking about parenthood. I better be thinking about motherhood if I'm a wife. And here it's about to happen to me. Well, I have to tell you that that's very late in the day to be concerning yourself with parental responsibilities, because you already should have been concerning yourself not with parental responsibilities, but with your responsibilities to be what you ought to be, to choose some values. Where do you want to direct your children? When you have no idea where you want to direct your own life. It's interesting to me. The young men are in a sweat to get married so they can direct their own household and don't even know where they're going themselves. And young people, terribly interested in setting up their own home, having their own children, and don't have any idea what direction they're going to take. It's a sad state of affairs. I wouldn't want to be on board a ship with a captain like that. I'd surely hate to be on an airplane with a pilot like that. It would be frightening. And I can tell you about children who are in the hands of parents who have no idea what they're choosing to be, haven't made a commitment about that, that it's frightening to think about these children with all a vast eternity out in front of them in the hands of people like that. You don't want to be a person like this. But look with me at some passages. You know, we often look at Colossians and Ephesians when we talk about parental responsibilities, and with good cause. Because in both of them, Paul addresses that subject. But in Ephesians chapter 6, which begins with the exhortation to children, who are Christians in this case, obey your parents in the Lord. Well, this is right. And then, more to our point tonight in verse 4, and you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You know where that comes out of? How does a father learn to bring up his children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? It comes out of chapter 5, verse 1, which is a clue to this whole business. And after chapter 5, verse 21. Chapter 5, verse 1 says, be ye therefore imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, even as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us. If you want to be a father or a mother to children that's a good father and a good mother, you better learn to be a good child to your heavenly father. You better learn that first. And the second thing you're going to have to learn is how to love other people selflessly. How to subject yourselves to others. And to be more concerned about their well-being than you are about your own. Now, if that's not the attitude, and it's not the attitude if you picked up the spirit of these times, because the spirit of these times is, dear friend, let me have my chance to be what I want to be and to fulfill my potential. And that is whatever I want it to be. It has nothing to do with values that I have received from some divine quarter. I'm not listening to God. I'm listening only to the impulses of my own mind and my own feeling. And I want to have my way, whatever the consequences to others. Well, if that's your attitude, you're not in a position to be a father or mother to anything. I'd hate to have you in charge of my valuable horses. If I was a mind to have any valuable horses. I wouldn't want you in charge of my dogs. Because people like that don't have any values. They're interested in themselves, and I know good and well if it ever got inconvenient to feed the dogs the horses, that it would just not get done. I wouldn't want anything that was important to me in their charge. And so what we're thinking about tonight is the sober responsibility of rearing our children. And in Colossians, I just finished this thing up. Where do you think Colossians chapter 3 and verse 21? Fathers, provoke not your children that they be not discouraged. Where does that come from? It comes from chapter 3, verse 1. If then you are raised together with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated on the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things that are above and not on the things that are upon the earth, for you died and your life is hid with Christ in God. Now, if that's true of you, then you're ready to begin your adventure and your responsibility as a father or a mother. But if you have not made up your mind to seek the things that are above, if you have not learned to be a good child to your heavenly Father, if you have not learned to love as they have taught you to love, then you're not ready for this task. And so I say again what has become almost prosaic with me, and that is that if you're not a devoted Christian, you're not prepared for marriage. And I want to add to that this codicil: if you're not a devoted Christian, you're not prepared for parenting. Because this kind of selfless mentality, this kind of set of values is necessary to direct and instruct children in the way that the Lord wants them to be directed and instructed. Well, simply our task to prepare children for heaven. I mean, that's a rather high and lofty thought, isn't it? We're not just trying to get them ready to be engineers or how to be good domestic engineers. Our task is to get them ready to pursue the highest goal of all. They have been put in our keeping by the one who ultimately owns every last one of them. He's the Father of our spirits, and he's saying to us, now it's your task. I'm giving you this blessed opportunity and this blessed task to prepare these children to be my children and to live with me always. That goes without saying, if you haven't made that commitment yourself, no way in the world you're going to help these people. First principle here. If you're going to be a godly parent, if you're going to instruct and guide according to these purposes of the Lord, is that you need to study the Bible and pray with your children. Now, you know what that sixth chapter of Deuteronomy says. It speaks first to the parents when it says that you ought to love God with your whole being, whole personality. You need to get that down. And then in verse 7, when with your whole heart you love the Lord, and you know that's more than just an idea. That's a way of life. It's a commitment. It's a governing principle that involves the way I think and the way I speak and the way I behave. When you got that down in your personality, he said, thou shalt teach them diligently to thy children, and shall talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Now, I want to tell you what that said. You can't do this in a short time. And you can't do it with little time. Being a successful parent, being a godly parent, requires a great deal of diligence, forethought, commitment, and it requires time. The thing I would ask to mothers and fathers in this age and generation is, Father, if you're always at the job, and if your responsibilities of earning the livelihood have taken nearly every bit of the time you've got, until you are hardly seen around the house, and your children hardly acquainted with you, my question is, why? What's the motive? What is it that's so important that you have no time for your family? And I ask the same question of working mother. Most important question to ask working mother, same question to ask the father who's just so overwhelmed with his job. So deeply involved and so deeply consumed by his job that he has no time for relationships. The question to ask is, why are you working? Don't talk to me about quality time. All time ought to be quality time. I know there are a lot of mothers and fathers who spend a lot of time with their children that's useless. I know that. I spent a bit of time with my children that was useless too. That was my fault. Because my parenting didn't have a sharp enough edge on it. Because I was not focused enough. Because I wasn't thinking enough. Because I wasn't committed enough. That's the simple truth. I was occupied with other things instead of paying attention to my business. But I want to tell you something. You better ask yourself why you're out there working. If you think this is the way to make the great contribution to your growing children, and there is nobody that can replace that mother in the home environment in the early years, and even as time passes, it's not just a cultural thing. The Lord said that he wanted the young widows to marry, to rule the house, to bear children and rule the household. They are to build and to nurture the home. It is their unique ability. Nobody can replace that. A man can come in and try. He'll do it when he has to. And it'll be a blessing when there is no other course. Because he will love and he'll try to shape and form and nurture and uphold the personality, growing personality of these children. But a mother is uniquely equipped for that. We're going to suffer no little because of our working mother. And because American women are now in a great quandary about whether it's going to be children or career. And I want to tell you that some of us have been pushing our daughters into careers. Not because we think it's wise and advisable for her to have something she can do in case something happens to her husband, or she might not be married, but so that they can somehow reach their potential. I really appreciated what Ms. Bush had to say at Wellesley College. I'm telling you, I saw an element of courage in that woman, standing up before those highly career-oriented young ladies at Wellesley, which is one of the most prestigious women's colleges in the nation. And a quarter of whose student body said they didn't want her up there talking because she had no position to offer a model to them. I want to tell you, she told the truth when she said, when the time comes to end your life, and that's something that not many speakers at those times in a student's life want to call attention to. They talk about all the bright prospects of the future, but nobody talks about where life is actually going to lead. And she just said, you heard it. When you get to the end of life, you're not going to be so much concerned about whether you close that deal or whether you reach the height of your profession, but you are going to be deeply disappointed and deeply concerned about the time you didn't spend with people. People are more important than jobs and careers. I want to say that to husbands and to fathers. The same thing applies there, but especially to the mother, who's called to a high calling. It's an aberration in American society, this notion that we've all got to get out there and each one find his fulfillment. Men and women are all alike. Shouldn't be any difference between us. There is a difference. And it's not artificial. It's God-given. And we don't accept those roles that God has given us and work together in that complementary way that the Lord has put together a husband and a wife to accomplish the rearing of children. We're going to make a mess of things. Study the Bible. Teach. Where? In informal ways. You got to have time to do that. You got to be thinking if you do that. You got to be thinking as you're going up and down the city in the car with the family. You've got to be thinking as you're on some vacation trip. You've got to be thinking as you're taking the children to school. You've got to be thinking as you bring them home from school. You've got to be thinking as you're taking them to the doctor's office. You've got to be thinking as you take them to some social occasion. You've got to be thinking all the time if you become this kind of parent, because you're always taking opportunity to instruct and to guide. Not in a formal way, but just along the way. You've got to imbue these children, I've got to imbue the children, with the idea of loving God supremely. That He's above everything, and that He's worthy of that. Not only am I compelled by the very facts of the case, since He's the Creator and I'm the creature, but I am impelled and I am drawn by the fact that He loves and cherishes me so much. I'm telling you, we have got so many people who have thrown themselves away like so much garbage. And this liberal, humanistic philosophy that has invaded our society has caused people to think so little of themselves. I must instruct and teach my child what God has said. And not just what God has said, you understand, but to instruct him about God to the extent that there comes to grow up within him a responding love for God. A real love for God. And I got another task, too. It doesn't have to be mentioned in this particular text, but I've got the task of teaching this child to experience a selfless love, to love your neighbor. As Leviticus 19 first said, as yourself, and as Jesus echoes many times, as you would therefore that men should do unto you, do ye even so to them, and even to bring them to the point that they can love people that don't love them. That's my task as a parent. That's my paramount task. Those two great principles have to go home in various ways. As they're experiencing life with their friends and there with the relationships that are developing for them, and as they see me and my conduct in the relationships that I have, and the most fundamental relationship of all is my relationship with my mate, husband or wife, they need to see this principle of loving God with all the heart and loving your neighbors yourself preeminently in that relationship. So, we need to study the Bible with them and to pray with them. And I want to tell you that the one who's primarily responsible for seeing that the family prays together and worships together and thinks about God together is the husband, the father. Not the wife. She has a remarkably important role to play in this. But it's the one who's said to be the head of the wife and the father of the children, whose task it is and who's mentioned both in Colossians and Ephesians as the one who is not to treat his children in an undue way, but he's to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It is not a case of the father saying to the wife, listen, I trust you, you take care of it. He must be seen as the leader of the family spiritually. So therefore, he needs to be seen as the one who leads in worship and in prayer, who leads in discussing biblical things. I think in too many instances we've got couples where the father is not seen as the nurturer of spiritual value, but the mother does it, and the father just sort of leaves it to her. If that's been your case, if that's your inclination, I'd just like to tell you right now, from my own experience in it, it won't work well. And that's not the way God intended it. Of course, all this is going to make you pretty sensitive to your own example, because you're not going to teach what you don't do and get the children to do what they're not. Second thing I want to talk with you about is spending time and listening to them. There's a great deal in the Scripture about communication. James tells us in the first chapter of James that we ought to be swift to hear and slow to speak and slow to wrath, and that's one of the great principles of communicating with others. The basic principle is love. You want to know how to communicate with people? Love them. Think about them. Cherish them. Value them. And if you value them and you have a concern for them, you're concerned about what they think. Yes, I mean even the things you think are terribly mistaken. I mean the things that just to you seem to be so picayune and inconsequential. One thing that happens to parents, I think, without a doubt, is we don't listen to our children. Somebody said, well, no, they're supposed to listen to me. I'm the parent. They're supposed, when I speak, I don't let them just, you know, if I'm speaking, they better not turn their head away. I won't let that happen. I expect them to give due attention when I'm speaking. Oh, yes. What do you do when they speak? Grunt a few times, go about doing whatever else you were doing, and they know good and well you're not listening. And sometimes when they do speak, we say, oh, that's silly. Right? That's silly. Why are you so concerned about that? Or we tell them when they fall down, you didn't get hurt. You're all right. We will not even give them permission to suffer pain. We will not give them permission to be disappointed. We will not give them permission to experience any kind of psychic trauma. I want to tell you something. Children suffer at the level children can suffer at, and it's painful. Don't you remember? I know it may not be lasting. I know that now. I did not know it then, and you did not know it then, but we act as though they ought to know it now. They don't know it. Learn to listen to your children. And that means look at them right in the eye. Go where they are and stand there and listen. Instead, we have some of these conversations on the run and we don't give too much attention. And then, after having gone through the early years of our relationship with our children at this level, we are so disappointed and angry when they come to adolescence because they won't listen to me. And I can't talk to this child. Probably not. Maybe you haven't been talking with that child, communicating with that child for years. I tell you, you better lay the groundwork for communication in the pre-adolescent years, because when the adolescent years come, they're tough enough without having an already established communication problem. So, spend time with your children. Listen to your children. And if they get hurt, just say, I know that hurts. I'm sure that hurts. And when they have a broken love affair and it's just puppy love and you know that and it's not going to kill them, don't say, oh, you'll survive. Just say, I'm sure it hurts. Let's talk about it. Got some time to talk with them. Give them some new insights. Help them to get through it. Tell them about how important it is in all relationships to trust God, how important it is not to let any disappointment overwhelm you. That you must not say as a result of this disappointment that somehow you're not worth anything or that life is going to all go bad. But it's all right to listen and to have some compassion for the pain they're feeling now. You understand from your more adult position that this is not critical, but for them, it's the worst they've ever had. So, spend time with them. Talk with them. Listen to them. And, of course, as an expression of that, a very important expression of that, give them affection. Titus 2, verse 4 says that older women are teaching young women to love their husbands and to love their children. That's a training process. And mothers, you need to learn how to love your children. And may I say that fathers need to learn the same thing. When family affection is being referred to and applied to the family of God in Romans chapter 12 and verse 10, the statement is made, in love of the brethren, be tenderly affectionate. Let me say that that's said because that's the kind of relationship that ought to exist in a family. Tender affection. That means it's all right to express your love. It means it's all right to touch and to give a hug. It means it's all right to show that you care. Some of us almost seem to need permission to do that. Because we didn't learn ourselves in our own home life how to show affection. And so it comes with great difficulty to us, although we need it desperately and we know how important it is to us. Our children need that kind of love expressed. And so there needs to be the showing of affection. And I would urge you, although I know it's not everybody's style, that there are simple things that do that. Just touching somebody as you go by. Even a joking bit of good humor in which you just sort of tease somebody. With sensitivity, of course, because there's some times in the life of a child when teasing is not received well, and I'm thinking now about certain things that you might tease your adolescent child about. I mean, it's good to be wise. But it's good to let them know what you think about them, that you're on their mind, and that you care about them. They're as important as you're guiding, and as you're the teacher, and you're the instructor, and the mentor, that you know that you're their loving teacher. That this is not mechanical with you. That you're not just doing this because they came along and now it looks like we're saddled with you, so we've got to get the job done. Give them affection. Let them know. And if you're not disposed to do that, learn to do it. Remember? Train them to love their husband, love their children. You can learn it. No, that's not me. I know maybe it's not you now, but think about who you were when you weren't a Christian. Is that the me that you had to be? Or did you reject that me and say, I'm going to be a different one? So now, even as we grow up in Christ, as you face the challenge of being a parent, learn to be a different man. Here's something we have to do. We have to teach them discipline. We have to exercise discipline. I know that, and you know, that Solomon said in the Proverbs more than once that the spare of that rod was to spoil and destroy the child, that the person who withheld the rod of discipline from the child did not really love the child. And you know the corresponding statement that is made in the Scripture that God chastens every son that he receives. And that's an absolute fact. But there is an absolute necessity for the child to learn direction in his life, which means a respect for authority. It means that there are certain things that you respect because that's the way God made the world. Number one, your parents. Children obey your parents. They have to learn that. You have to instruct them. And it's important as you're guiding your children and you are directing them that you be consistent, that you be fair, and that you be loving. But direction must come. And it just simply means you're going to have to say to your children that you've got some responsibilities I know you don't like. But that's the way it is. And you must do these things. Some children grow up without any sense of self-control whatsoever because they were never disciplined by their parents. They were never disciplined. They're just exactly like one of David's sons about whom it is said he never asked them why he was doing anything. No wonder he grew up to be such a mess. And so many of us just sort of let them go willy-nilly. That's not teaching, that's not direction. There is no truth to the old idea that you just let a child go in whatever direction he wants to go, and somehow or another there's something natively noble inside of him that's just going to find itself and he'll be what he needs to be. That's not true. He needs guidance, needs direction. You're the one who's put in the position of doing that, and I'm sorry you can't resign your post. Teach the child discipline and a respect for authority, a respect for your authority, first of all. And if he's to respect your authority, it must be because ethically you are consistent in doing what you want him to do. And you are consistent in giving an example of what you are calling upon him to grow to. How else can he respect you? No child is going to respect a parent who calls upon him to do what the parent doesn't do himself. Who calls upon him to do what the parent is in constant violation of? And teach him to respect government, as the Scripture teaches.
Every king, every governor, every power that is, that's established by God, we need to learn to respect. Without that kind of respect, society cannot exist. It would fall into anarchy. It is necessary that we do that, and we ought to show that kind of respect to our children and teach our children that.
But unfortunately for many of us, we're in a constant rebellion against everything that powers it be. We talk with contempt about all this civil power, and I need to be careful about that myself. Always speaking ill of the powers that be. If we teach our children contempt for these authorities by what we say, how will they learn to respect them?
And if we say about these individuals that they are not good morally, we can say about them, but God has permitted them and put them in a place and said that we are to respect them. And so if we cannot respect them, we can respect the God who told us to submit to them. And we need to learn that kind of discipline. Our children need to learn that kind of discipline. And, of course, it all needs to reside in the fact that we've taught them to obey and to respect God, that we must obey God rather than men always. But that's the most important mandate of our life, is to obey God. How will that come across? By saying that once or twice a year? By making that observation now and again, infrequently? No, it must be the atmosphere which permeates their existence. Until they see us continually asking ourselves the question. And always resolving every difficulty by asking ourselves and determining for ourselves what is the will of God. Because we reverence Him. They will learn as a consequence of what you teach them reverence and worship. Another thing you need to teach them is the value of honorable labor. I've never seen so many young people as in these times who simply don't want to work when they don't want to work. And there are a lot of reasons for it. The fact that maturity has been delayed in the American family because we send our children not only to grade school, where a lot of people went, and that was the end of it 100 years ago. I mean, you were fortunate if you got learning to read and to write out of the way before you got down to the business of earning a livelihood. And then we sent them on to junior high school, and that was about as much as a lot of people used to get. And then we decided everybody's got to go to high school, and we'll penalize those that don't, so we got high school. And now everybody's got to go to college. And when they get to college, now they get to graduate school. So, I mean, they're already 25 years old before they've even had any responsibility at all. And we live in an urban society where work for the children is hard to come by, and it's a lot easier to have that done or to hire somebody else to take care of that than to have them do it. And I want to tell you that is a mistake. As Andrew Carnegie said about his vast fortune in regard to leaving it to his children, I think he left them $50,000 apiece. Which was a lot of money in those days, but nothing to compare with what Carnegie owned. He said, I'd just soon give them poison as to leave them money. To destroy them. We've got to appreciate the fact that the thing that taught us to be what we are is having met the responsibility, and when we take that off the shoulders of our children, we are destroying them. They need the responsibility of having work to do, which is important work, which is significant work, and which has to be done and must be completed. And when they don't complete it, there's a penalty. They've got to learn these things. They cannot grow to maturity ignorant of responsibility, incapable of saying, this is something that has to be done. I have the diligence and the commitment to do it. And at the same time also, so riddled with procrastination and lack of focus that they just, their whole life just runs like water over the ground in all directions. The Bible has something to say about idleness. If you read Proverbs, you know again and again it talks about the sluggard. But he talks about the practical consequence of it, that they're going to go hungry, that their lives are not going to be happy. But when you get to the New Testament, you read words like that in Ephesians 4:28, which says, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have wherewith to give to him that has need. That is a charge to earnest labor. And I think in all things, as Romans 12:11 says, in diligence, not slothful. Diligence means persistence. dogged commitment to a task. And I'm telling you, if what our children learn, if you can't do it in 5 seconds, I don't want to have anything to do with it. If it's not easy to do, I don't want to try. If it takes a lot of endeavor, I don't want to be involved. Can you imagine what that will do to them in their lives? Can you imagine what it will do to them in a marriage relationship? Can you imagine what kind of Christian they'll learn to be as a result of never learning diligence, never buckling down in self-discipline to a task that has to be accomplished, which they alone can learn, which they can learn from you alone? That's the task. Therefore, work needs to be done by every child in every home. They need to have responsibilities given to them, and that expectation needs to be made. And when it's not fulfilled, penalty. You say, oh, you just want to use your children for servants and slaves. You just like to order them around. The easiest thing, my dear parent friend, is to do nothing and let them do what they want to do. You could stand the mess and the horrendous total chaos a lot easier than you can the constant conflict. I mean, the days for a parent, oh, I just don't want any more conflict. That would be the easy way out. Just say, do what you want to do. Let your room look like a catastrophe. Don't wash. Don't go to school. Don't do anything. Leave me alone. But that would be the cry of the selfish spirit. And what they need is discipline and consistency and constancy and love. And you cannot be, as I've told you many times before, you cannot be their peer. You are their parent. And therefore, you're going to have to be the hard fella sometimes. You're going to have to be the bad guy, acting always out of love. But guide them in the choice of their entertainment, their companions, and their dress. Guide them in the course of choosing their entertainment because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And what we're putting in their hearts makes them what they are, and entertainment is a part of what they're taking in. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. You want to let them watch filth? There's so much filth in this world for them to see. I'm a little bit amazed, frankly, as a parent whose children have grown up, I'm a little bit amazed at some of the things that parents are looking on with seeming indifference to what their children are watching in terms of movies. I am. Even some of these PG-rated movies would give you cold chills sometimes. And the language, we just sort of learn to live with that. I'm not trying to give you some rigid guidelines, but I'm telling you, be sensitive to what your children are getting, not only in terms of violence and nudity and profanity, but in terms of philosophy. What are they watching? What is the message of what they're seeing? What's going home as a consequence of that? You need to be concerned because that's, you know, how much television? Please, control that. Don't let them watch so much television. Becomes their teacher and their mentor, and they're getting more out of that than they're getting from you, and you don't want that to happen. So help them in choosing their entertainment, and sometimes when they want to do what you know is not best for them, just say, no, I'm sorry. But I don't like this, and my friends are going, and everybody else in the church is doing it. Well, you just say, I'm sorry. But you belong to us. And those parents will have to do what they have to do, but we have to see to you because God's put you in our care, and we have to act out of what we believe is best. And we're pleading with you to trust us and hope you will, but no. And when it comes to the matter of their companions, exercise control and direction there too. 1 Corinthians 15:33. How many times have we heard that? Evil companionships corrupt good morals. And that's an absolute fact because the companions you keep are the ones that you try to imitate and emulate and you share together life. And we're talking about companions that are not just occasional. We're talking about real companionship. And young people are looking for that kind of companionship. And when it's the wrong kind, it can be disastrous. Yes. Far better we hear the language of Proverbs 13 when it said, walk with wise men and you'll be wise. So you choose those companions that will be helpful to you, that will be elevating, and not those that are going to destroy your moral principles. And thirdly, be concerned about their dress. You know what I've seen through the years? As parents lead their children in the matter of modesty and purity in behavior and in dress, I've seen parents endure in their children what they would not practice themselves. I've seen parents allow their children to do what they would not do themselves. To wear clothes they wouldn't. Now, you understand me. There's a different style between somebody that's 15 and somebody that's 40. And you wouldn't want to wear the same. We understand about that. And I hope you understand that. But I'm talking about the brevity of the dress and the sensual expression of it. You wouldn't, Mother, you wouldn't wear that, would you? You wouldn't do it. But when little Mary and Susie, whoever, oh, everybody's doing it, and I need, oh, I love, this is the stylish thing, and my heart would break. My heart would break if I can, it'll be the end of my life. Oh, by all means. Where is the direction? I say to mothers of small children, do not start them out wearing things in their innocence that they are not going to be able to wear when they're adolescents. You know I'm not talking about what little babies may be wearing. I'm talking about when they're coming closer and closer to the time when they're going to come to adolescence. You don't one day say, well, honey, you're grown up now. You can't wear that anymore. We need to take thought for that. I want to give you a guideline. You can use it or throw it away as you will. But I just don't believe that anything we wear ought to be shorter than the dresses we're willing to wear. And I think, young men, we need to recognize also that we can be guilty of a sensual kind of display by the way we dress or don't. What message do we want to give to the world? What message do we want our children to give to the world? That the most important thing to us is purity and holiness and character within. And we're not going to be caught up in styles that issue some other kind of message. I can't give you the guideline with the ruler. But some of us need to be thinking more about what we are wearing ourselves and what our children are wearing, along with the question of companionship, along with the question of entertainment, along with the whole picture. I'm not wanting this to be seen as just one single issue. But I want to ask yourself the question, if you think it is good and wiseable and helpful in the cause of Christ for you to take your children to the beach and everybody go native, because there's not anybody here that knows us. Or to the motel swimming pool, because nobody here knows me. I tell you, the Lord knows you. And whether you know these other people or not, there's a behavior pattern that's developing here that doesn't look good. And if you believe that that kind of dress, which is characteristic of the beach, is all right for you, it ought to be all right for you away from the beach or anywhere else. In fact, in this society, it absolutely is. That's just the way we tend to dress most all the time. We need to give thought to wearing modest dress, expressive of godliness. And then, finally, just one thought. Teach them to seek the kingdom of God first. Do that, first of all, by doing it yourself. Be active in all the work and worship of the church according to your ability, with your heart being manifest in it as your children see that. And supervise their studies in the Bible classes. Don't ever. I mean, how many times have you asked your child, how's your English class? How's your math coming along? What are you doing in school? Let me see your report card. What's going on up there? I'm supposed to go see your teacher. And yet, no question whatsoever about their spiritual development and the classes they're involved in this assembly. Does that teach them something? It really does. It says, this is not important to my mother and father. But I'm telling you, that stuff down to public school, that's important. And third, don't ever let school or social activities come before serving God. Don't ever do that. Because there is nothing else in this world that is more important than serving God. And our children, above all, need to know that. Don't we want them to know that?
I was going to read some things, and I don't really have time. Something that Brother Gardner Hall wrote to his son, Sewell and Bill, when he was dying. He said, the decree now seems to be that I cannot be with you much longer, but I'm seeking to dwell on the wonderful blessing that I have been privileged by God's goodness to have been with you so many years. How wonderfully blessed we have been. How much for which to be thankful. When you were born, we were very conscious of our fearful responsibility. We knew you were facing an evil world. We could not think of a greater tragedy than to rear children who were not Christians and they're being rejected in God's judgment. So we took our responsibility seriously. We prayed daily for wisdom from the very first day you were born. In fact, before you were born, We taught you the Bible as soon as we could you could comprehend it. You never knew what it was to miss any service the church held. This was true from the first day your mother was able to take you. Your place at service was always a front seat. You helped to sing and to show reverence during the service. Very rarely were you punished for being playful or talking during a service, but you were watched carefully, and misbehavior was not tolerated. We attended practically all gospel meetings within reach of us, and there your behavior was the same as at home. We were stern in our discipline. Commands required prompt obedience, no second reminders. Prohibitions were not forgotten. We did not turn our heads the other way. We agreed on discipline. Sometimes discipline was administered by required readings of biographies and other edifying literature about which Brother Sewell has told you. Whippings were accompanied by loving admonition. Often you wondered why you were denied going to places you thought to be right. We did not simply prohibit on our authority. We tried to show the dangers involved and give good reasons. You learned very young to submit to authority. This you had to be taught, and you have done so all your lives. You respected constituted authority from that of God all the way to the most humble lawmakers. Both of you respect the Word of God and preach it faithfully. You are respected and loved by God-fearing men and women because you live the Word in your lives. You are both richly blessed by having wonderful Christian companions and obedient children, all of them a credit to you. I do not wish to imply that we were perfect parents. I, especially, had so many faults. I was high-tempered, impetuous, impatient. My redeeming quality was my willingness to repent and apologize. Only in this way was I able to maintain the confidence of my family. You were patient and forbearing, and you never doubted for a moment that your daddy loved you. Now I must leave you. It is such a joy to see that you have followed our counsel and especially that of divine wisdom. It is so much easier to bid you farewell as a faithful Christian and as gospel preachers. I go with a happy heart, not with a crushed one. That is the reward of the Lord. And we invite you to take seriously your task of guiding children so that one of these days you'll be able to write something like that. Brother Hall died when he was 73, but his work was well done. So our task remains. We're here, our children, our grandchildren, and all the children that we can influence. That's our task and our responsibility. Let us set them a godly example, influence them in the way of the Lord by being what we need to be. If you're not a Christian tonight, therefore unprepared to be a maid or a parent, come and submit to Christ and let him guide you in this most important role while together his name.